Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 29th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Howard Bryant, writer at ESPN Magazine, commentator at NPR Weekend, author, Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. Also joining us later in the program, Alex Perrine, staff writer of The New Republic and host of The Politics of Everything. And on the show today, Violence Rocks Minneapolis for another night as citizens call for accountability for killer cops of George Floyd. Meanwhile, Minnesota AG Ellison expects charges for those cops. And Amy Klobuchar's record of looking the other way at police violence suddenly becomes very, very real. More Floyd protests in Denver as 7 people are shot in Louisville protesting another killing. This one from March. New revelations in the Breonna Taylor killing come to light. Meanwhile, Trump's stupid executive order regarding social media is legally hollow and, again, stupid. Real question is, why is the Trump administration so adamant about selling more and more weapons to Saudi Arabia? Texas Supreme Court decision may disenfranchise millions. Speaking of millions, with over 40 million people unemployed, that's 1 out of every 4 workers. Many others are watching their salaries get chopped. Tom Cotton and other Republican senators now want to limit Chinese immigration. Funny how that works. Some good news. The U.S. has consumed more renewable energy, this is from last year, versus coal for the first time, well, in 134 years, but probably forever, or at least in the life of coal. And the Republicans are insisting that North Carolina make a decision regarding their live convention, and that they do so by Monday. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, folks. It is Friday. Not feeling so casual, frankly. We're breaking format, but it's not a casual Friday. There's a lot of anger and disgust and sadness in the air, and overlaying the general malaise of this lockdown and all the crap show involved in that. We bumped our ads for today, and I'm going to talk to Howard Bryant, who I spoke to. I don't know. I guess it was. I think we actually did the interview right before this lockdown, and We ended up playing it a little bit later, but a really great writer, and just wanted to get his reaction. His book, Full Dissonance, was very much about Black anger and frustration in this country. And, you know, this week in particular, and the aggregate of the deaths when we talk about coronavirus are just, you know, another example of why, you know, people have such anger. So let's just go to this clip. This took place yesterday. I imagine most of you are aware of the story of George Floyd. There's more information coming out now about the relationship between Floyd and this cop, Chauvin, who was the one who was digging his knee into his neck for 6, 7, 8, 10 minutes. Certainly 6, 7 minutes before Floyd passes out, and then a couple more minutes while he's laying there unconscious as people are yelling at him. But we will get to that. But part of the reason why there was more violence and anger last night, and we also have video that is going around that at least, you know, we can see where the first acts of sort of like, I don't know, vandalism or a sort of like prompting the looting come from. We know, we have very clear video of the person who did this. It is unclear who they are, but the video, I've got to tell you, I find it hard to believe. And you know, I don't want to, the last thing I want to do is get out over my skis on this. And there are people who are reporting this out, you know, working, trying to confirm sort of some of the theories around who this person might be. But it is very hard to look at this video and walk away with the idea that this was one of the protesters who started essentially, or lit the fire, if you will, for the looting. Very, very hard to believe that it's one of the protesters. But we will play that video later in the program. Let's start with this one. This is the Hennepin County DA, Mike Freeman, who came out Thursday afternoon and had this to say. Sound.
It's a violation of my ethics to talk and evaluate evidence before we announce our charging decision, and I will not do that. I will say this, that video is graphic and horrific and terrible, and no person should do that. But my job in the end is to prove that he violated a criminal statute. And there is other evidence that does not support a criminal charge. We need to wade through all of that evidence and to come through with a meaningful determination. And we are doing that to the best of our ability.
Okay.
Just say. I bring the same message that African-American Attorney General of the state of Minnesota, Keith Ellison, is bringing. I'm bringing the same message of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We have to do this right. We have to prove it in a court of law. And I will just point to you the comparison to what happened in Billy in Baltimore in the Gray case. It was a rush to charge. It was a rush to justice. And all of those people were found not guilty. I will not rush to justice. I'm going to do this right. And those folks who know me in the African community know I will do my very level best. But I will not rush justice because justice cannot be rushed.
So now, you know, when you listen to his first part of the statement, it is it's a lot worse than the second. And he did a bad job, it seems to me, in addressing this. Like, I think as a lawyer, and Keith Ellison, I should say, came out Friday morning, so this morning, and he said he expected the four Minneapolis police officers. He said, I anticipate there will be charges. I hope they're soon, he told CNN. He said, however, the charges would be the prerogative of another prosecuting authority. That is this guy, Freeman, who is the Hennepin County DA. And he said, they're trying to make sure their case is strong and airtight. Everybody believes that this is a violation of Mr. Floyd. And I believe that everybody wants to see these charges filed as soon as they can be. But again, I do want to say that we have seen cases that seem so clear go south. So, you know, it's clear from just looking at the video why there would be anger as a response to that, because the guy is being, you know, he's got a pretty bad bedside manner, as it were, and doesn't realize that this instance, you know, it's as if there is like this sort of absence of understanding that this is not just a technical legal case. That may be his job. But because he's the only person who is in a position to execute that job, he also has to be aware that this is about the relationship between an entire segment of the population and the entity that has a monopoly of force and is using it and abusing it to kill people. And he doesn't seem to have any sort of like situational awareness of what's going on. I think it's perfectly legitimate for this guy to come out there and say, look, I need to do this right. I owe it to George Floyd. I owe it to the members of the community. I owe it to the state, the county, whatever it is. I owe it to everyone to do this right. I don't want to fail at this. Mm-hmm. What we saw was reprehensible. I don't want to fail at this. And I understand why people are impatient. But if I'm going to do this right and make sure that any charges we bring stick, I need to do it right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way that you got to address this rather than coming out and saying, yeah, there's evidence on both sides.
Because that makes it sound like wait until we leak some stuff to the press about Floyd, that he was no angel. And then all of a sudden the case goes away. That's when I hear him say there's evidence that we can't say. That's where my mind goes immediately.
And it could go three or four other places too, but that's the most, that's the most reasonable place to go. But regardless, it's going to piss people off because it's going to sound like you're stonewalling. And, you know, maybe the guy is stonewalling, although, you know, the second half of his comment made it sound like, you know, a little bit less, but it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me that they can't get this right. I don't know. It's crazy, really crazy. Do we have Howard?
Yeah, I'll bring him on now.
Okay. All right. We want to take a break. We got him on the line. Let's bring him on.
Okay.
Want to welcome back to the program, Howard Bryant. He is a writer for ESPN magazine. He is a commentator on NPR Weekend Saturday edition. author of Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. Howard, welcome back to the show.
How are you?
I'm doing okay, I guess, all things considered. Really appreciate your joining us. And, I feel like we're on the brink of a really horrible summer. And I think that, I don't know. I just want to get maybe some of your thoughts in the wake of what we're seeing and how it's being handled. This is all happening between Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, and also the thing that happened in Central Park, which in its own way is even like a sort of like another level of really just pure evil in some respect. But then this is all in the backdrop of a vast disproportionate number of African American people and Latinos and low income people dying in this pandemic. Where are your thoughts today?
Well, my thoughts are always with the people on the ground, and they're always with the people who are actually doing the struggling and the suffering. And I think you're right. I think that when I look at what's been taking place here, you see a combination. It is that sort of perfect storm where you look at what's happening, not just with the continuation of police shootings and police killings of Black suspects, but also happening in the middle of a pandemic when you've got that disproportionate amount of Black and brown people who are being affected. And also to have that number affect, or the type of person who's being affected, affect the reopening. There is in the Black community a great feeling that as soon as it was identified that the Black and the brown and the poor are the ones who were suffering the most, it was, okay, well, let's get on with it. Let's get moving. Those people aren't that important. So therefore, now that we know that it's not the important people who are being affected by this, we can get on with our lives. And so you have that happening. And then you also have this happening at the exact same time. You've got this interesting juxtaposition of the these white protesters at state houses and down in Huntington Beach. And so when you're looking at this mix of things that are happening at the same time, it feels, it doesn't feel like we're bordering on dystopia. It feels like we're here. We've already arrived, and we've been heading here for a long time. I think one of the things that I've been thinking about, and there are so many different components here, but when I think about New York and Amy Cooper and that situation, I think one of the things that really struck me about that is, you referred to it as evil, it struck me as practice. I looked at that video and I felt this was not her first rodeo. I was like, this is something that was... But then again, this is also, when you think about it historically, the basis of segregation in so many ways, which was to protect white women and to protect this, this asset, this valuable, valuable asset. And when you start to see how that manifests, it reminded me a little bit of Rodney King in some ways, where when that moment happened, before that had happened, people said, well, if only there was proof that people do this. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but if only there is proof. And what she gave you was proof of how that works.
That Amy Cooper thing is like watching Emmett Till. I mean, it was.
Well, and you know what? For Black people, and I talk to a lot of my Black male friends who have dated white women, and we also to have a little inside joke laugh about it. I don't know if I'm breaking the code by talking about this out loud, but we're like, yeah, this is something that they do. I mean, this is something. I mean, it has happened to me in my past. I have Black male friends who have had white girlfriends who have said to them, if you walk out that door, I'm calling the police, that they know that this is a protection for them. They know that this is a weapon for them. And I think that when we think about these things, we don't assume that people weaponize the weapons as much as we think. But let's face it. If you live in this country, you know that the police are there to protect you. And what I saw most about that video, what really hit me hard about that, was the fact that she identified him as an African-American to the dispatcher before the dispatcher even asked what he looked like.
Right.
That told me that this was practice, and this was an understanding of who the system protects, who it belongs to. And also on the other side, it was interesting, a number of my Black friends that we talk about who were saying a very interesting moment of feeling of liberation on the part of Mr. Cooper, that he felt the freedom to actually engage with this person in the first place. I don't talk to white people when I'm walking by. I don't talk to strangers at all, because I don't feel like if there's some sort of engagement with them, that there's protection coming my way, even if I'm in the right. So I thought that there was an interesting reminder there as well, that even if you feel like you're within your rights, you may not have any rights.
Well, that was basically her, that was the message she was sending. Is like, you got no right to say, to actually engage in me, with me. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, she also said, she said to him first, like, I'm going to call the cops and tell them there's an African-American man.
Well, that's right. I mean,
she had it absolutely down. And, you know, a lot of people were speculating, like, you know, what is she doing at work? Like, yeah, you know, like, how is she weaponizing this stuff at work? Because you don't just pick that up in that moment. I mean, this is
What are you doing to my son's 529? I have one with Franklin Templeton. I'm like, I hope you don't have my account. But yeah, right. There was that. And then there was the other part of it too, where it was, she even knew that she was being filmed, and that didn't stop her. That was her way of saying, you can film this. You can have all of this documented, and they're still going to be on my side. So there was an absolute sort of understanding, at least in her mind, about who justice served and about who police served. She understood that. She understood that so brazenly that it may have been the most true thing I've seen all year.
Yeah, I was going to say that video is obviously the violence in that video is certainly not as graphic as the one you see with George Floyd, but in many ways it's the type of violence that is like in some respects just, I don't know, I think a little more disturbing. And I'm wondering, you know, when you say, like, you know, we don't think that's weaponized, I mean, what you're talking about is, I think most white people don't know that's weaponized in that way.
They don't believe it's weaponized, and where that weaponization comes from is the inherent belief that the police are your friends. And that's the difference in the weaponizing. The Black people they know not to believe that. So therefore you can say, okay, if something happens, I can use this. I can use this in my favor. And I can also use this in my favor because I know it's going to hurt you no matter if it's true or not. I know that when they get here, they're on my side.
Right.
And that is to have these two moments take place so quickly and so, you know, to parallel themselves so vividly in New York and in Minneapolis, it was a reminder of how power works and who power serves. And I think that one of the things that has been bothering me is that false equivalencies always bother me. But I think one of the parts of it that really bothered me the most was the number of people in the discussion where I hear them say, well, look at the white people who are storming the state houses in Michigan, and no harm comes to them, as opposed to look what's happening to the Black community and the protesters in Minneapolis. And I'm like, they're not even close to the same thing. Number one, when you watch the protesters in Michigan, you know, they're walking in there with AR-15s. They are armed. They've got they're armed with guns. They're armed with the American flag. They're armed with rocket launchers. And the guy's got a bazooka slung over his shoulder. But when they engage with the police, who are not in riot gear, who are not carrying, I mean, they're armed, but they're not holding their weapons. They don't have billy clubs or anything like that. The difference is that those protesters, they're not asking for anything. They're telling you.
Right.
They're walking directly to the police and they're telling you, this is ours. We have a right to this. And we're taking what's ours. We're defying because it's ours. We're owners. And when you look at the Black protesters in Minneapolis, they're grieving because, number one, there's somebody dead here. They're not upset about not being able to get a haircut. You're dealing with, one, a murder, Two, you're grieving that, you're mourning that, and you're also asking for something. You're asking for justice, you're asking for humanity, you're asking for the law to protect you. And eventually, over time, all of those frustrations together, as we saw here, as we see in Ferguson, as we saw in Watts, and take your pick, as we saw in Cincinnati back in 2002, I think it was, on all those different moments, the end result ends up being the same, which is, as much as you're frustrated about the murder, what you're really frustrated about is the lack of accountability and the fact that zero tolerance exists in every other facet of our culture, except when it comes to police. So there's no arrest here. This is what is creating the tinder, right? That's the kindling.
That sense of, propriety that those protesters, so-called protesters had in going in to these state houses is just, there's this quality of like, you work for us.
That's right. We're telling you, and that's the reason why in Full Dissidence, in my last book, that's the reason why the last chapter is called Renters. That's what we are. They are constantly reminding us who owns this country and who has a piece of it and who it belongs to and also who it doesn't belong to. And when you see that, that right there is the seat, right? You walk in and you see it on both sides. You see the protesters walk into the state house in Michigan and they're right in the faces of the police and they're telling you this is ours, right? Secondarily, you also have the police. The reason why they're not in riot gear is they don't feel like they're in any danger of being harmed. They don't feel like there's any attack coming. They're just there to block the door. They don't believe that there's any type of confrontation that is going to put either of their lives in danger. It's essentially owner talking to owner. They just happen to be upset at each other, right? One is maintaining and the other one is angry. But when you take that away and you look at Minneapolis and you see them shooting pepper spray into the crowd, you see them, they are looking at them like our job here is to suppress you, is to put you down. And you see that difference. You see that difference in propriety. We don't have anything.
Right.
And that's the reason why when things explode, they explode the way they do.
One is viewed as an argument amongst equals. The other is our enemy is coming and we need to fight them off.
Oh, and we need to kill them.
Yeah.
And that is that really is that difference. Who owns this country? Who has a stake in it? And who gets to be told to leave? Who gets to be told they don't have a piece of it? And I think this idea of zero tolerance is what is really important. As we talked about, whether we're talking about Colin Kaepernick's protest back in 2016, when you listen to what Kaepernick was saying, he talked about paid vacations. He's talking about unaccountability. And if you had more accountability from juries, if you had more accountability from district attorneys, if these guys were under arrest, I don't think that explodes the way it does. Instead, you've got Minneapolis coming out and saying, well, you know, it's sad, but we don't really see that an actual crime was committed. That's going to explode the entire town.
Let's talk about that, because it seems to me, I mean, there's two sort of like, I guess, species of responses that you could expect here that are possible. Like, you know, one is sort of deal with sort of like much bigger structural questions, right? But then there is this sort of almost banal, this is just operations. Genuine accountability. The stories have come out that Klobuchar, when she was DA in Minneapolis, Minnesota, I had multiple occasions, it sounds like, to prosecute this guy, the specific guy, Chauvin, and to others, and declined, for whatever political reasons, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's involved there. There's also this sort of like broader question of, we're in, you know, Donald Trump's DOJ is not going to be on these things in the way that Obama's was by the end of those 8 years. And
Obama didn't get the successes and the results that the people wanted. So what's going to happen now?
Well, but there's two sets here. One is like, what does it do to the frustration level where the anger and the frustration when there's at least a sense with Obama's administration, and I just say this, broadly general, I have a lot of complaints with Obama's administration, but there were consent decrees. There was the Office of Civil Rights at the DOJ was considered by critics of Obama's DOJ that was the best division that they had. At least there's a sense of like, if we push hard enough, there's responsiveness. With Donald Trump's DOJ, you know, whether it's Sessions or Bill Barr, I don't get the sense that like it, you know, like this is just, there's nothing, you know.
Well, you're not going. I mean, I think that, and I think what's interesting about that when you compare the two Justice Departments is that what Obama did was so basic, it appeared to be revolutionary.
Right.
That all he did was actually try to hold them. And I have the book right behind me here, the report from Ferguson in Baltimore. And you look at this, and it in Cleveland as well, it wasn't as though that these guys all were arrested and went to jail. They were just investigated. I mean, that's the basic level of due diligence. And that was considered revolutionary. That was considered remarkable. And so now you look at what's happening here. I mean, let's not forget, this president came in immediately and said he condoned cracking these guys over the head. He condoned more and more police violence against citizens. And of course, he did it last night on social media, or this morning, whatever time it was, on social media. And so I think that what is reinforced to you is this isn't yours. What's reinforced to you is that this does not belong to you, and that what are your recourses? It's a level of frustration. And I think that this idea, once more, when you talk about fairness and you talk about ownership and you talk about belonging and you try to co-opt the language by saying our country and our land, these things remind you that that's not the case. And so then where do you go? Your pocketbook is empty. You don't own anything. And you're mourning death. You're watching a death on video. Because let's also look at the long view here, as we talked about earlier. The number of years pre-Rodney King where people said, okay, well, we hear you, but if only there was some proof. Look at all the proof you have now. If only we could see what was happening. And then when that happened, then you saw the goalposts moving and people said, well, we didn't see what happened before the video was filmed. So you reach this sort of zero point, this point where you wonder or you're resigned to the fact that, okay, where do we go? You can't go here for justice. You're not going to get justice. You're going to get killed while being filmed. And I don't care what that man did. Forging a check or whatever does not mean that that's the last day of your life. I'm sorry. I don't believe in any of that. And so you reach a point of explosion. And when I'm watching those videos, it's very sad to see it, just like it was sad to see in Baltimore, just like it's sad to see in Watts, and you see all these different places, because eventually Black people still suffer even more.
Right. But at
the same time, you can't look at those videos and say, I just don't understand what's happening. You understand what's happening. We all understand what's happening.
The level of frustration, it seems to me, is just going to be enormous. As you know, one, there's no reason to believe that as we continue on with the policies that are being, you know, laid out in terms of the response to the pandemic, that we're going to see any less disparity in deaths and suffering from the pandemic amongst African-American communities. There's just this sense that there's not going to be that, you know, Donald Trump is going to go out there, and I don't know. I mean, I feel like we're going to have a better sense in a day or two as to how he's going to exploit this, right? I mean, Colin Kaepernick, you know, as far as he was concerned, was a huge gift, at least from his perspective. Yeah. And it's interesting as you set it up with this notion of, like, you know, we hear people say our country and our, you know, I saw a clip of Tucker Carlson talking about the most important thing is that our society be, and he is really talking to just the owners of the society.
Exactly. Whose society? And that's 100% right. And I think that the more you look at this, you think about all the different tentacles that come with these stories, and you end up looking at the end result. And the end result is what it's always been. Race, class, and gender, the three third rails of this country, they cannot be separated. And obviously, in this case, you've got race and class. And obviously, if you add in gender, on both sides, you add in the Amy Cooper story. So you're looking at all of these different things tied together. And in terms of the end result, you do walk away from this with an incredibly pessimistic feeling. And the question to me has always been, when you hit these types of moments, what are you going to do with it? And we have to frame these things. We always frame these things within the guidelines of this American exceptionalism, as if we are somehow special. This has been the story for a very long time. This has been the story, period. And we keep believing that there are going to be corners that get turned where we can talk about this being yesterday, and we can't. And I think that the number of people who are expressing that level of frustration, sometimes it frustrates me when I hear them express it, because they make it sound like it's something new. And what you really need is something that we've never had, which is a real deconstruction of law enforcement. Because to me, when I look at everything that's taking place, the root of both of these issues that you brought up to start is the idea that law enforcement is designed to protect white people and to kill black people.
Right.
Right. Whether you're talking about Central Park in New York, that woman, that's attempted murder in my mind in a lot of ways, because what she was hoping for, you don't know what's going to happen when they get there. But she was expecting some form of violence toward that man, that they were going to come there, sirens blaring, and they were going to take care of him to whatever degree that was going to be that day. And when you look at the video of George Floyd, you're witnessing the same thing you witnessed with Eric Garner. And you're witnessing this, and you are watching a man die. And I was talking about this with a friend of mine the other day, and we were saying, even in a war, because they don't show war anymore, they don't broadcast this stuff on television like they used to, how many different times do you watch people get murdered? And yet when it comes to black people, when you're talking about Walter Scott or Eric Garner or now this situation, we are watching black people get murdered. And to me, that is heinous. That is unconscionable. And yet it's something that is accepted. And what does that do to the people? Because I always look at it this way, Sam. At the end of the day, it's a black person dead and we're mourning his passing. And if you accept that, that tells me a lot about what this country is. And it's not where it's going or we're bordering on or heading toward, is who we are right now. We're in the dystopia.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like on some level, I just, on days like this, I just feel like I want to come out and just apologize,
I think what it is I think it's staying on target, stay focused on two things. Joe Biden, where are you? Joe Biden, where are you? You stay focused on accountability. Once again, if you want to fix this, you don't fix it by apologizing and hugging black people. You fix it by going forward and saying, we demand zero tolerance of this.
I mean, that's the thing that's what I find so frustrating, is that, at the very least, if Joe Biden is in there, there can be demands made of Joe Biden and of the way that the federal government, at the very least, reacts to these type of things, proactively goes in and begins to dismantle these police departments.
Well, that's right.
But we're in an environment right now where it's like there is no one to place a demand to who gives a damn about it.
Well, there are plenty. You've got a Democratic governor in Minnesota.
Right.
He's not anything. Right. You've got an Amy Klobuchar who's on the verge of becoming a vice president. There are plenty of people who can do things. This is not just the Donald Trump Republican administration thing. This has been going on at a local level for 200 years. Right. Ever since the advent of police departments in the first place. Right. There are plenty of things that can be done. And it's really interesting when you look at where we are in this country and people talk about how the worker is completely being bludgeoned by privatization. We talk about how much the worker is being smashed in an anti-union environment, whether it's the Supreme Court or at your day job. The police union is untouchable.
Right.
These guys, they got fired. There's a really good chance, A, they're going to get their job back. And B, if they don't get their job back, they'll get a job somewhere else. Right. There's whatever the Floyd family decides to do, or whether the Arbery family decides to do, whatever these families or the Breonna Taylor family, whatever they decide to do, they're going to get some sort of civil settlement from the state, but it's not going to affect those police departments. There is no incentive, and there's no fear. There's no incentive. There's no morality for any of those police departments to change, because they protect each other to the point where they know that there's no accountability even in a police report. They are completely indemnified. And as long as that power dynamic is as overwhelming as it is, we're going to be having this conversation very much so more in the future.
Right. Howard Bryant, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We'll put a link to Full Dissonance on our site. Thank you enough, and can't thank you enough. And I, stay safe.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Do the same, Sam. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and hopefully when we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Perrine, or we'll be relatively close. Let's just take a 1 minute break, Matt. Back. Sam Cedar, Majority Report. Sorry for the slight technical difficulties. Joining me now is the staff writer from the New Republic. And I say the staff writer because he is the staff writer of the New Republic. And of course, I know he's probably a host of Politics of Everything, but I still consider him the host of Politics of Everything. And he's in the midst of shooting a film noir movie. Alex Perrine, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Sam.
I don't know if you heard any of that conversation with Howard Bryant we just had about, you know, the horribleness that is involved in Minneapolis, that is involved in what happened in Central Park, what happened in Louisville, Kentucky. and or happened in Georgia. I mean, the list goes on and on. And in the sort of the midst of the pandemic, which has also been, you know, one more manifestation of the inequity and the injustice in the way that our society is constructed and maintained. I don't have anywhere to go with that, really. I mean, there just seems to be an abject failure on every level. And, you know, like the Klobuchar thing is, I don't want to sort of dwell too much on that, but it is a prime example of if someone who's being considered in this day and age to be the vice president of a guy who won, not exclusively, but pretty much as a function of African-American support, the primary, is contemplating this person to be his vice president. And I would imagine if there was ever an opportunity for her to be a vice president, that's out the window now.
Yeah.
But just that she could rise through the ranks and have this record of abject failure in the one lever that we have that could obviously not rid society of this, but mitigate, you know, sort of the complete wantonness of these cops to be able to, you know, extinguish Black life, you know, with like, you know, I don't know, in the way people make a, you know, small appliance purchase, right? Yeah. It's maybe some measure of contemplation, but yeah, boom, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's fucked up.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, it's all part of this very depressing realization that the pathways to power, and you know, I always get annoyed when people speak strictly electorally about stuff like Klobuchar and her record, and they'll Democrats in general, and they'll say strictly things like, and less so now, but beforehand it would be like the discussion would be like, well, you know, that might not hurt her to be seen as a, you know, as a moderate. It might help with these demographics, and like I really just think like it with the discussion should just be like the record itself is bad. Like it right. doesn't like the electoral aspect of it is secondary to the fact that we should just decide we don't want to advance people with these records anymore.
Right. The horse race assessment of what constitutes a good or bad record. There should be some broad principles of like when you have cops who kill people and who have 10 complaints, as this Chauvin guy apparently had.
Yeah.
Like, it's incumbent upon you to do things, even if it means, you know, risking your viability. I mean, on some level, it also, you know, there's also another way to look at this. Or just like, you can even like elevate up another 5 or 10,000 feet if you want to talk about behavior. You know, when we look at Democrats in the House, the Senate, the number of prosecutors that are there,
yeah,
it seems to me, is a problem.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and this is not, you know, we have now some DAs and stuff like this. There's a movement out there where they are reformers. Okay. And so there's not necessarily something wrong with these positions, but all the prosecutors that we have now who are in a higher elected office are not reformer prosecutors.
No.
There's a movement afoot to, you know, make sure that if Biden, you know, becomes president, that he doesn't pick judges from corporate lawyers. Like
right.
the pools in which we draw our candidates, or which we draw, you know, candidates or nominees or whatever. This is like something that is constructed and can yeah. be constructed. And yeah. maybe it should just be that, like, if you're a prosecutor, we should have a greater awareness that that is a liability for your yeah. running for higher office
yeah.
in democratic circles.
I mean, I think what it comes down to is the way the sort of democratic professional class, like, determines qualifications is you know, you have to have, you know, they're sort of like, well, we have, like, as you know, one of the groups of people from which we find candidates are graduates of certain law schools who worked for certain firms or who were elected prosecutors or DAs. And like, that's just like one of the pools they look for. And I mean, I don't know. I have been for a long time saying like, we need to like stop electing so many prosecutors. And I mean, now maybe people will actually listen, but it reminded me of, I don't know. There was a report a few weeks ago that like, it was, I think Biden pledged to appoint Black women to the Supreme Court. And the story was like, well, he's not going to find very many in these appellate courts. He just won't find very many. There just aren't very. And it's like, you can appoint anyone to right. the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Like, you literally do not have to find someone.
They don't have to be a lawyer.
You don't have to be a lawyer.
They don't have to, not only not, they don't have to be from the appellate court. They don't have to be a lawyer. And certainly, you know, it's like, what we will hear is folks like Chris Coons say like, well, this person's not even rated by the ABA because they're not a, you know, there was a lot of people who were rated poorly by the ABA who are now sitting on the federal court because with Donald Trump. The narrowness of the thought that I think that we have, and part of that is also a function of like, you know, the vestige, and hopefully, you know, I feel like someone my age is just sitting here, like just, you know, watching the changing of the guard and just hoping that it happens quicker. Like, it's really not, you know, my generation, I feel like we don't participate. Like, just like get these ideas out that are from literally from the Nixon era.
Yeah,
that Democrats need to show their law and order bona fides to be able to compete in a general election, and get that out the window. Like, that's what I get. Like, you know, I see like Chase Boudin and Krasner and Philadelphia, where you see like people taking positions of this to specifically undermine what these jobs have been doing in the past.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily younger, although Chase is, but like this, this idea that, you know, Democrats don't need to appeal to the general electorate by showing their law and order bona fides. I mean, that's why we get so many prosecutors.
Yeah.
There's still this mentality of like, we've got to butch up. You know, we're a bunch of soy boys.
Yeah.
And we need prosecutors to make us look tough or something.
It's a hangover from the 70s and from the 90s. It was like the peak of crime in the U.S. came at the very beginning of the 1990s. And for whatever reason, it's been declining. It peaked then. It's been declining ever since. But the people who learned politics in that era will not give up any authority. And they're still picking according to those rules. And it's, I don't know, it's silly. And you look at somewhere here, like here in New York. We have a mayor who is mayor because he promised to take on the power of the police and to, you know, to rein in the police. And he now, like, in his second term with no electoral considerations whatsoever, like, will not do almost anything
right
to change the political power of the police. And I don't think he would suffer any political or electoral consequences if he was more aggressive, except that the cops would throw a tantrum. But they can't get out. I mean, they cannot stop being held hostage by the political power of police, basically.
Yeah, they can't seem to get out of it. All right, let's play. I want to play a couple of clips. Minneapolis is your hometown, it just occurred to me.
It is, yeah. Yeah. It is, and I mean, it's been surreal. It does not, like, my mother was at the protest the first night, it really, I mean, it's just been completely surreal watching it happen. It's heartbreaking too, but yeah.
Let's play some from clips from this, because the footage coming out of there is pretty stunning. And it's I mean, a lot of it's like an indictment of the cops, to be honest with you.
Absolutely.
And again, the failure to really have any significant oversight of these. I mean, if I'm Joe Biden, just, you know, as an aside before we get into this, if I'm Joe Biden, you know, I'm announcing tomorrow, I am setting up a, you know, I am tasking a commission. A lot of people, you know, have some extra time right now. I'm tasking a commission, and within 30 days, I want them to come with me to me with a plan to basically go in and I want like a set of federal restrictions. I don't know how they could, you know, I don't know how the, you know, they, what would fit in from some type of like constitutional framework, but like, I want a set of restrictions where there are tripwires, where, you know, these numbers of incidents, we're in there automatically. No questions asked. There's no debate. It just happens. These are the tripwires. We need to require these amount of reports. We need this amount of data. We need to have a central clearinghouse of like of complaints that if you get, you know, if there are more than four complaints lodged over the course of a year against your police force, we need to know all of them. We need to see all of them filed. You know, seven complaints, a representative goes there, whatever it is. But like something that he, a commission, not for to study once he gets into office, yeah, but like for a set of plans that he has over the summer.
Yeah.
Saying like, this is going to be instituted on day one. I don't even need any of the other bullshit. We're doing this on day one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, all right, let's play this clip. This is apparently the Minnesota police arrested a CNN reporter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does anybody want to guess what color the reporter is before we play the clip? Let's play the clip.
Yeah.
Right now, give us a second, guys. We can move back to where you'd like. We can move back to where you'd like here. We are live on the air at the moment. This is the four of us. We are one team. Just put us back where you want us. We are getting out of your way, so just let us know. Wherever you'd want us, we will go. We are just getting out of your way when you're advancing through the intersection. So just let us know, and we got you. And this is a scene here playing out in Minneapolis. This is part of the advanced police presence that we saw come over the course of really minutes when the local police showed up at the fire department, or with the fire department, I should say, on that building we showed you that was burning. This is among the state patrol unit that was advancing up the street, saying and scattering the protesters at that point for people to clear the area. And so we walked away. I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir? Why am I under arrest, sir?
Officer, you're with CNN and he's on the air right now.
Okay.
You are arresting him live on CNN. We told you before that we are with CNN.
If you're just tuning in, you are watching our correspondent, Omar Jimenez, being arrested by state police in Minnesota. We're not sure why our correspondent is being arrested.
Hang on 1 second, Allison. Let's listen into what these officers are saying. That is an American television reporter, Omar Jimenez, being led away by police officers. He clearly identified himself as a reporter. He was respectfully explaining to the state police that our CNN team was there and moving away as they would request. And then for some reason, he was just taken in to police custody live on television. I'm sorry, I did not mean to interrupt you, Allison. I just wanted to hear, listen to see if we could hear more from the officers, the state police, as this is going on.
Yeah. We're trying to see what's going to happen, John, obviously, to the rest.
I'm about to, guys.
We were just out here reporting the closure of the streets. They just, Omar was just arrested. I believe they're about to, we're all about to be arrested. That's our producer.
Our CNN producer is being...
I'm probably going to be taken in a minute.
Our CNN camera crew and our producer are being arrested right now on live television in handcuffs.
I've never seen anything like this.
Why, guys, why, what is...
Allison.
Why are you arresting us? We're just passing along the message, your message. I'm done, you know, we're just out here doing our job as well as you are.
We can do that.
Tell me what? What are
we under arrest?
Okay.
Behind your
I'm being arrested now.
Yeah.
I gotta put. Can I put the camera down?
All right. Well, I mean, we get the. There are two thoughts, like, right. One is like, this is pretty shocking. Of course, you know, there's a lot of stuff that has happened in this context. You know, a cop put his knee into the back of an unconscious man for like 4 or 5 minutes right. after he had knocked, you know, basically driven him to unconsciousness. That's also shocking. Like, I mean, but,
it's the impunity that these guys feel. Right. And it's also, it's complete incompetence too. Like you don't, we have seen the cities, in America, have moments like this more than once over the last few years. And we've seen the police act horribly. Rarely have we seen them just act with the sort of staggering incompetence that they are here in terms of like, it's just stupid to arrest a CNN reporter live on air. That's just stupid. My feeling is that, and you know, I feel like having my experience with Minneapolis cops, and those were the state cops, which is pretty much even worse, is that these are primarily extremely cloistered people who do not like the city that they are patrolling and do not like the people in it. And I think that they are showing throughout the last several days that they're not even very good at doing, like getting away with the cop bullshit that they do when they're trying to, when the cops sort of quote unquote, let people burn down a Wendy's or something, what they're and not intervene. They're trying to like show audiences at home, well, if we don't do our policing, like these animals will run wild. But like the Minneapolis cops and the state cops are just so bad at that part of this routine that they're going around making themselves look worse by arresting CNN reporters. I don't know.
But here's the question. Is it that they're incompetent? Like there's two different things that breed incompetency, right? One is just like they're idiots.
Yeah.
And they're bumbling fools. The other is that they're so arrogant that they do not even recognize that they need to put on like an Eddie Haskell type of quality to this.
Right.
Where they need to project something to, you know, the people at home. They just think that they are so beyond reproach that they ride so above like any type of accountability that they make these type of mistakes. Right. Like where like the you just did this on air. Like everybody saw how you guys are not being terribly reasonable here on some level.
Yeah.
The other thing about them being outside the city, this is one of the oldest and to some extent it happens, you know, maybe there's some measure of it happening naturally. Like, you know, a lot of cops in New York live out in Long Island, fairly reactionary place. But when I was in Cuba 20 years ago or so, one of the things that we were told is that that Castro specifically brought the cops in for Havana, brought them in from the countryside because there was a hostility to the, you know, supposed sophistication of Havanaites relative to those in the rural areas. And the rural areas were going to be a lot more loyal to the Castro regime than city dwellers were perceived to be. And they, you wanted the cops, you know, it was just what we were talking about with Harold Bryan. It's like, you want the cops to perceive themselves as a, as an enemy, as a natural, right, that the people they're policing are natural enemies, right, of theirs.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways you do it, just with this geographic divide.
Yeah. And right. And in the Midwest too, I feel like in large Midwestern cities, there's an additional racial component of the only part of the region with racial diversity is this city. Cause like these people, the cops are from basically all white enclaves. And that's true in a lot of places in America, but I feel like in places like Milwaukee, it's worse. In places like Minneapolis, it's worse. Like Minnesota is an incredibly white state outside of this one metropolitan area, which is fairly diverse. So like there's definitely, I think that exacerbates it way more in those types of regions too.
Right. We get it. In Michigan, there's that same dynamic. Yeah. I mean, it's here is a bizarre coincidence. It is unclear. I mean, should we even play this from the city councilwoman? Because it appears that there has been some, at least confirmation of this, but not for the 17 years. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, maybe we should skip it. I mean, it basically looks like they worked at the same club together, but the cop might have worked outside and he worked inside. So there's no confirmation that they actually knew each other. But I mean, it's possible. So who knows?
So one of the, well, you know, sort of, I don't know, maybe it's a coincidence. Maybe it it is something more. But Chauvin, the killer, worked with Floyd at a club together for much of 2019. But it's unclear that they knew each other, although I don't know. I mean, it's not like there's a day and night shift, right, at the clubs. I mean, maybe they were on at different times every day, but I don't know how many people work at that club, but that seems like a bit of a coincidence. All right, let's play this footage. I don't know if you've seen this. This is going around. I know for a fact there's a lot of reporting outfits who are trying to do work on this. I have hesitation to play this clip, or to the extent that I have any hesitation, it's this. I mean, obviously, we're going to play these two clips. One is, we're going to speculate on who this person is.
Yeah.
But I don't want to get into the specifics because there is some speculation as to who this person specifically is. But I'm more just interested in making observations of the video. The other is that you don't like to sort of like play video from some of these scenes because it can help cops identify some of the organizers. Now, it's unclear to me that you could identify from anybody from this, but also these are just people who are not doing anything illegal at all. You know, they're not even protesting. I mean, or some of them, they're obviously there for the protest, but they're more reacting to what this guy is doing. And so I think, you know, on those accords, we're okay. So this all started, and maybe you even know the, I don't know if you know the geography here. The first place, and this happened Wednesday night, maybe?
Yeah, Wednesday.
Yeah.
The first place where we saw reports of so-called looting were at this auto zone.
Mm-hmm.
And there is video now of how the windows at the auto zone first got broken, which ended up that people started pouring in and taking stuff out, and that basically snowballed. But as the cops are starting to like use flashbangs to push people back towards the auto zone, not many people are there yet. The lines, as it were, are like, I don't know the orientation, northwest, south, but it seemed to be a couple hundred yards away. So you don't even see the mass of protesters. This video has emerged of the person who broke the windows. Now, there's protesters there. I want you to contemplate, like, this instance where these windows were broken in the manner that they're broken. If people can imagine that this is consistent, I've been to a lot of protests, yeah. Some of which have gotten, you know, there's been some, you know, vandalism and breaking of glass and not particularly full on looting. But this seems to be very atypical.
There's no audio on this clip either, okay. Just to be sure.
There's a guy. He's got that umbrella. He's got a mask on. He is literally going by with a hammer, one by one. Somebody tries to stop him. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
He could go by those mirrors, those windows with a hammer, just smashing them casually, and then walks off. And there are people, other protesters are filming that guy and looking at him. Then a different video, someone with a different video camera catches this guy as he's walking. He's about 15 feet away from where he just smashed those windows. So this is almost continuous footage. There he is. That's him. He's walking away. He's got an umbrella. People are trying to figure out, like, who is this guy?
Looks like, yeah.
He's casually walking away.
This guy just came with a hammer and smashed the windows.
I'm gonna fight you right now.
You wanna
go?
What's up?
Somebody
hold my blunt.
Hey!
Somebody hold my blunt.
Trying
to get the camera. And then you can hear the flashbangs because they're pushing the protesters in this direction. And that's the end of the video. I mean,
I think I've seen the speculation you're talking about. And like, I mean, the guy is not outfitted like the sort of protesters I have known who go do protests in places like Minneapolis. Like that. And I think, like, actually in, like, in our current era, there is a thing that happens where right-wing provocateurs show up to cause trouble at events
in all eras.
Yeah, right,
frankly, exactly. I think it's like provocateur it's, is a, you know, yeah. I mean, we're talking this is I don't know. There, you can hear people on the videotape ask him if you're a cop and whatnot. I don't know if that's a cop. I don't know if that's like a, you know, a proud boy or somebody. Right. But the chances of that being a protester,
right?
Even one who is looking to create, you know, it's conceivable, you know, it's not inconceivable. Let's put it this way, that you have, like, you know, somebody out there, you know, I don't want to besmirch any particular ideology with it, but people who are just like, more violence in this situation is good. You know, we need some violence. We need an explosion here. And they aren't doing it as a way of necessarily like putting protesters at a disadvantage, but they see it as advantageous for society in that respect, as opposed to a right-wing agent provocateur. If there was people like that, that would not be a single person.
Mm-hmm.
They would not be geared up in that fashion. Yeah. You know, I could see like multiple people doing it, but like, you don't go into that situation with the level of confidence that that guy had.
Yeah.
If you are a protester afraid of the police,
right?
I'm sorry. You don't do that alone. You bring a couple of guys going in and doing something like that because they think this is what's going to bring about the revolution. But that guy had a level of confidence in doing what he was doing.
Yeah.
That you do not see.
Right.
You know, like, he was very much prepared. Like, I'm going in. I'm smashing those six windows. I'm doing it as calmly and as methodically as I can.
Right.
I'm turning around and I'm walking, you know, like.
Well, that's the thing, too. It's like, why, if you, if you're there, if you are, if you are an actual protester looking to escalate as part of your actual protesting, why are you walking away? Like, why are you, you're done? You finished?
I can come up with a story where that person wants to walk away and change their clothes so they don't get caught by the police.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But why are you walking?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, why are you walking?
Yeah.
You're, there's no police around there.
Right. And you, so
you're amongst protesters. You run away and then get into the phone booth and change your clothes or into your car and change your clothes. Like, the behavior is not consistent with someone who is afraid of the authorities. Like, I can understand why you, maybe you have an umbrella. They use that in tear gas, but it is hard to believe that that person's not some type of agent provocateur, as it were. I mean, who they are, we don't know, but, that, you know, I think
people should keep that in mind too. When they see images from this, I have been keeping a sort of in my head when I see images of like vandalism, I've been thinking to myself, like, that one looks legit. That one looks fake. Like, right. I think there's like, it really, and like, there are bad actors intentionally trying to fuck this situation up. And then, wanted to get further out of control to cast the entire thing in the worst possible light. But I do the way that particular person, the lengths that they've gone to hide their identity, you know, make you wonder. Not like, I don't, is it, are they worried about getting arrested by the police, or are they worried about the internet finding their identity? Like, which one?
Right. Like, a protester in that situation, a non-agent provocateur runs.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no reason for that person not to be running, unless what they're trying to do is not draw attention, as opposed to not get caught.
Yes. Yeah.
He failed at not drawing attention. If that person cannot be ID'd and pursued, that in and of itself is a bit of an evidence as to who they might be.
Yeah.
Because the cops are very, very effective. You know, with that amount of videotape,
right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This whole thing is just, you know, a disaster as far as I'm concerned. And by the whole thing, I'm talking like the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have footage of protests in Denver where somebody tries to run over a protester. We have footage of cops assaulting a man in a car in California. Let's play this clip of Tucker Carlson, because this clip really. Let's play this clip of Tucker Carlson. We talk about sort of the reactionaries.
What we do know is that riots are now acceptable because racism is a national emergency. That's the new standard. Okay, so now that we're in a state of national emergency, the question is, what is not acceptable? What's not okay? Anything? Here's what some of the, quote, protesters were chanting last night in Minneapolis.
Shoot the white folks! Shoot the white folks!
So you're not going to see that clip on CNN. How come? It's simple. Facts like this, and there are a lot of them, challenge the carefully constructed storyline that our leaders richly profit from. Therefore, those facts must be suppressed. For example, practically every day, we're told that white cops are a mortal threat to black men. And some are, obviously. It's what started this whole thing. A black man was killed by the police. It's awful. But what are the national numbers on this? Well, actually, we know the answer. A study from last year found that white police officers were less likely to shoot and kill non-white suspects than non-white police officers were. In any given year, police kill more white suspects, armed and unarmed, than black suspects. And that's a fact, by the way. It's not political propaganda. It's provably true. Yet no one on television will ever say that because that fact threatens the scams they're working.
So Tucker Carlson will have us believe that there is no danger to black people from the police relative to white people. Mm-hmm. He's not doing a per capita thing. Of course.
No. Yeah. It was just, yeah, just by the
sheer numbers.
Yeah. You don't want to get into like how large the populations are number wise right. when you're using those stats, but there's that's a brilliant example of the guy with the TV show saying no one on TV will tell you this too.
Right. Exactly. The biggest numbered audience on cable television.
If what he was saying were true in the way he meant it, then surely his audience should also be rising up against the police.
Absolutely. And they should feel very, very insecure. And in fact, he could have done that whole segment of like, boy, Amy Cooper's really an idiot. Why did she think that if she said African-American man is attacking me, that would have any resonance?
Yeah.
She should have said white man is attacking me because we all know the police kill more men.
They're more likely to kill him. Yeah.
Boy, is she stupid.
Yeah.
I wonder where she got that idea. She must watch CNN all the time.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is just a very well-practiced, deeply racist a guy on television mixing in a little bit of economic populism because you want to get into that circle of trust. Mm-hmm. Particularly he's got a little bit of a hurdle to get to because he's an heir to
heir to a frozen food fortune,
Swanson empire, and so he's got to get into the circle of trust with his would-be racist populist crowd. But I mean, that guy is just, it's just despicable. It's Bill O'Reilly, right? But with a little bit, you know, with a, I imagine, a prep school pedigree.
Yeah. The Tucker's background and even the sort of conservative he was a few years ago just show, I mean, it's just sheer contempt for his audience. I mean, really, he just thinks that they're the dumbest people alive. He really, and you know, he's done very well for himself with his estimation of his audience's intelligence.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's two things that I always think about with Tucker Carlson. One is, I know for a fact, during the Iraq War, he would sit on that set of Crossfire, promote the shit out of the Iraq War, walk off set, smoke a cigarette in the back, of the lot and say, like, I don't really care about this stuff.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, I just remember when he started the Daily Caller, how it was a clarion call for conservatives to have real journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't get mired in this stuff. The guy just basically fly. It is amazing to me just how the career flexibility these guys have.
Yeah.
If it turned out that there was a dollar to be made as a conservative who did legitimate reporting, he probably would have stuck with it.
Yeah.
If he could get on TV.
I mean,
he couldn't. And so he just went back
I remember the Daily Caller thing because he went to CPAC and he got booed because he was like, you guys don't understand. The New York Times has editorial standards that the conservative media doesn't have, which was a true and correct statement. And they were like, get off the stage. And then he like realized you can't make any money doing conservative media with editorial standards. Like there's no market. There's no market for it. No one will fund it. And then he was like, well, you know, I used to make a good living being the sort of conservative you could have a show on MSNBC, like probably just time to move on to being a Fox conservative.
Right. And we should also say when he was on MSNBC, MSNBC was much more conservative.
Much more conservative. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was Scarborough who had a primetime show and it was Buchanan was also on there. But all right. So we have some breaking news. This is being reported by Ken Klippenstein at The Nation. Officer Chauvin, this is the one who took his knee and drove it into the back of of George Floyd's neck until he passed out and then subsequently died. And that was over the course of almost 10 minutes, has been arrested. There is no, however, a charging decision has not been made yet. So they're trying to work out what the charge is according to Ken Klevenstein. Hmm.
I saw the Hennepin County prosecutor, I think it was, had some insane statement where he
we played that up front, actually.
Right, yeah.
I mean, he sort of like clarified it as he went on, but
yeah.
It was a total lack of sort of understanding of what this guy's role was, what the relationship between police and the African-American community is. I mean, just a complete like... And I mean, that is a generous reading.
Yeah,
I should say on my part. I don't know. I mean, you know, this news has been sort of, has sort of dominated the week in many respects. But I want to just turn to another story that I found just to be sort of shocking. And then maybe we'll take a break and go in the fun half, and you hang around. We'll take some calls, and I think maybe hopefully Jamie will be able to join. Let's see. What is this? The wife of fired Minneapolis chief of police officer Chauvin was charged with writing a bad check for $42. I don't understand what that means, but. Did you hear this story from Pennsylvania? I know that yesterday on the show, Michael played like 5 or 6 minutes from this clip of this guy, Sims. I think his first name is maybe Brian. He is a Pennsylvania state senator. Have you heard this story?
Oh, wait. Was that the guy who didn't tell anyone that?
Yeah, he is a Democratic state senator.
Right.
The Pennsylvania Republican Party has been pushing, you know, like hard to open up Pennsylvania. Yeah. They are, I don't know that they're more gerrymandered than Wisconsin off the top of my head, but I do know that their districts, when they were congressional districts, because I think the congressional districts and the state Senate districts are along the same lines. I'm not exactly sure why the congressional districts were challenged, and the state Supreme Court basically said, you got to redraw these. These things are messed up. I don't know why it doesn't work for the state as much. But so the story is that the Republican Party was pushing to open up the state. They were having more sessions and more meetings of a particular committee. I don't know if it was like the government functioning committee or something to that effect. They're all the while pretending there's no danger to catching COVID-19 out and about. Apparently, there was at least one Republican member who was a confirmed case of COVID-19 who kept coming into work. However, at home, he was quarantined from his family. And they were doing contact tracing amongst Republican staffers all the people this guy contacted. They never told the Democrats that they were meeting with comedian, exposing. These Democrats included people who had kids, people whose wives were immunocompromised. And one guy, the guy who did the video, apparently had secretly, because he didn't want it to be politicized, donated a kidney in January to someone down the street from him, neighbor who he was a perfect match for. And so he was exposed continuously to this Republican who had an infection. And kidney disease, which is, you know, if you have one, is not technically, it is not kidney disease, but you don't have a spare.
Right.
Is one of the comorbidities and one of the problems that COVID-19 hits. And this guy, people should go back and look at this video that we ran from yesterday. You can find it online. It is this whole notion of like the Republican Party has really gotten off the rails since Donald Trump has been around. Like, what is it going to take for that zombie lie to die? These Pennsylvania Republicans did not need Donald Trump to be this sociopathic.
Right.
The whole leadership knew. They knew. Yeah, I mean, it sort of reminds me of what happened with like that guy, Foley, or was it that was, you know, like
Mark Foley or the
Mark Foley.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's there. I don't know. There's this complete amorality, I guess. I don't know. It's like it really just a complete non-interest in behaving humanly. But it obviously, like, these are, this is that you are completely right, though, that like the thing about this is that they are just normal Republicans. They are not people who were turned this way by Donald Trump. They are people who chose to be a part of this, you know, to whose conservatism led them to act this way.
Yeah,
it's committee meetings too. It's like that's the, being in an enclosed space for a long period of time talking with other people is just about the absolute worst thing you can be doing right now.
That it's is like exactly literally, it's like
that's at the top of the list.
Yep. I mean, short of like literally like sort of performing mouth to mouth resuscitation on them.
Yeah.
That is it.
Yeah.
That is the one thing that you should not be doing, is getting into closed spaces with people. Particularly, I mean, honestly, I think you should be charged.
Yeah.
If you know that you have that virus and you get into that situation and you do not inform people in there, that to me is like, at the very least, like some type of criminal negligence. At the very least, you know, you can't claim like, I didn't realize it was contagious.
Right.
There's a pandemic going on.
And if you're doing contract tracing around your peers, it's, you know, to conspiracy, but I don't know. It's
right. And also, yeah. And if you're doing contract tracing too, you've also like, you've effectively, opted out of any claim to like, privacy about your diagnosis, because you are right now tracing all the people you've come into contact with because you know that you might have gotten them ill.
It's unbelievable. I just think they should all be arrested. I mean, honestly, I think they should all be arrested. I think they should be fired. I think that Joe Biden should be out there calling for the resignation of the leadership of the House in the Pennsylvania House and Senate. And
I remember, right. That's right. It's, you do like, yeah. Like what, why the Democratic refusal to make that case, exactly, to say, just come out and say like all these assholes should resign. But it's part of this larger thing of just like not wanting to take on the Republican Party as an illegitimate and bad force as a whole, instead of like individually bad actors.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, it's just definitionally right. I mean, the leadership and the fact that it took this long for it to come out, like, I mean,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
I'm just amazed by that. I just find the whole thing just despicable. All right. Well, let's take a quick break. We're going to head into the fun half. And when we do, I don't know. We'll take some phone calls. I got some clips here, too, of like, you know, Donald Trump complaining about frickin' Twitter and Rush Limbaugh. I mean, these guys are just sociopaths. It's unbelievable. But we'll play more of these clips. I'm at wit's end, and then we can talk and complain about just all of it.
All right.
All right. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, hopefully Jamie will join us, and we will take some of your phone calls if we have time. Maybe IMs.
And... Do we want to do plugs before or after we do the?
Oh yeah, let's do plugs.
Okay. Bring Jamie on.
Just a reminder, folks, this program relies on your support. when you become a member of the Majority Report, you get the free show, and then we give you extra content, and you keep this whole thing chugging along. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We got merch. The merch is gone like crazy. Just remember, all of it's union made, all of it's sourced in America or made in America as well. And the masks, we don't get all the proceeds go to the Northwest Immigration Center up there, doing some great legal work for immigrants. So buy those and know that all the proceeds go to that. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Sign up for the AM quickie. What else? Check out TMBS, YouTube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. Who was on TMBS this week, Matt?
Dustin Gastella.
Dustin Gastella was on there.
Yep.
Check that out. Check out Nomiki Kant's show. Relatively new show. You can find it on patreon.com/ The Nomiki Show and Nomiki Kant's on YouTube. And Jamie, what's happening with the Intifada?
Hello. Well, this week on the Antifada, we had on Winnie Wong, former senior advisor to the Bernie Sanders campaign, to talk about a little bit about the campaign, what went wrong and where we go from here, as well as how her work with Bernie fits into her overarching politics as an anarchist. Also, we are doing a special Twitch stream today after the Majority Report at 3 p.m. With the Antifada. We're going to talk about the uprisings in Minneapolis and elsewhere. We have a cavalcade of wonderful guests, including people you may have heard before on our show, Pablos Rufos, Terrence from Trillbillies, Brandon Jordan, Leslie Lee III, and Cole James Cash from Ghetto News Network. So I'm stoked about that. And we're going to be doing it around 3. And I'm going to hop on as soon as I'm finished with the blog post.
Matt.
Last night at twitch.tv/literary hangover, I played Red Dead Redemption. I got to the fictional town of Saint-Denis while listening to the chapters from this book on the Mexican-American War. This is, I just dropped it, The Fatal Environment, The Myth of the Frontier, and the Age of Industrialization. So twitch.tv/literary hangover, folks, check that out.
Alex, did you hear that?
I did hear that, yeah.
Is that the strangest like show you've ever heard of?
It is a strange concept. I'm into it.
Thanks, Alex.
A lot of Twitch streamers are too. Do you want to plug Everything's Political?
New Republic, we actually just redesigned the website like today, so go check out New Republic. Politics of Everything is the podcast I co-host with Laura, and I think our last episode we talked to Dean Baker and Eliza Featherstone about the economy and COVID-19. Next episode will come out next week. Go check it out.
Oh yeah, love her.
It's a good pairing.
Yeah.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be back with the fun half. Amy and I make
left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 238.
56, 27, 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.